having introduced in that last session ideas about the Fisher Information Matrix, and you know they are very, very important. They run through a great deal of the literature, not just on analysing data you already have, but how you can go about designing a data analysis problem. You know, actually designing, if you think about it, a physics experiment or an astrophysics mission, in order that you can sort of know in advance how well you're going to be able to constrain certain parameters. So say you're interested in knowing the value of the dark energy density of the universe, which is a very popular area of cosmology right now, trying to understand aspects of the weird accelerated expansion of our universe. The kind of ideas that I just briefly touched on in that last lecture, where you model your posterior as Gaussian, and then you seek to understand how well you could constrain the parameters of your model, those might well be the first step that is done as people are starting to think about a future mission that might aim to constrain such a model, like, say, the dark energy parameters. We'll see a bit later on, when I talk about Markov chain Monte Carlo, that you don't always have to assume a Gaussian posterior, that we can actually do better than that now. But nonetheless, it's often a sensible starting point to look at this Fisher information matrix and see how well you might do. But another way in which you can improve your understanding of a problem is that you can ask the question, well, am I even using the right parameters? There might be a different set of parameters that describe the problem where you can get better information. And if you just re-parameterize it, then that would be a very quick and easy way to improve the performance of your data analysis. So that's what we're going to look at now. We're going to look at this idea that if you've got, in the simplest case, a two-parameter problem, then the way we've parameterized it to begin with, theta 1 and theta 2, results in a covariance matrix, Fisher information matrix, that gives us probability contours that are these ellipses. So they're elongated, and the axis of the ellipse is tilted. So that stems directly from the properties of the Fisher information matrix. It's basically saying, as I said just before we had the short break, that there's certain linear combinations of theta 1 and theta 2 which are well constrained, and certain other combinations which aren't nearly so well constrained. So what we're going to think about now is whether we could maybe make use of that to simplify a problem. Because that notion of building up the axes of an ellipse, it extends well beyond just two dimensions. So if you're talking about n parameters, well, you've got an n-dimensional ellipsoid, but it might be hard to visualize, but it's really the same idea as what you see here in the 2D example, that there's a set of axes of that ellipsoid, and those axes correspond to eigenvectors of the Fisher information matrix, and they're telling you the different combinations of the parameters which are constrained either very well or not so well. And we want to now ask is, can we make use of that information to maybe simplify a problem involving lots of parameters and turn it into one that's got fewer parameters? So we call this principal component analysis. It's a method for transforming a multidimensional data set consisting of a number of statistically dependent or correlated variables into a set of uncorrelated variables that we call the principal components. The first principal component is the linear combination of the original variables that accounts for as much of the variation in the data as possible. So if we go back a few slides to the picture in 2D, the first principal component would be the long axis here, because that's accounting for a lot of the variation in the data. If we think of the data as sort of being a sample from that posterior, so that sample would sort of fill that ellipse, and most of the variation in the sample is going to be along the long axis of the ellipse. So that's the first principal component. And the second principal component is the linear combination that accounts for as much of the remaining variation under the constraint that it's got to be orthogonal, it's got to be perpendicular to the first principal component. And that would correspond to our shorter axis. So this is a two-parameter problem, so there only are two components, two principal components, the first and the second. Now let's think about how this might relate to some of the ideas we talked about yesterday, where we were talking about fitting straight lines to data. And I thought I would come up with an example that was really not to do with physics at all, it's to do with the price of fish. People often say, what's that got to do with the price of fish? Well, now you're going to find out. This is data which comes from the 18th century, and it's the price of herring in the spring and in the autumn. And not being an expert in Scandinavian fishing, but maybe it's still not a big surprise that the price is strongly correlated. There's a strong correlation between the spring price and the autumn price. So there's only a small number of data points, there's only seven, but what we can do is we can construct the best fitting bivariate normal distribution to describe those data. And we can construct from that, from the covariance matrix, or the equivalent of the Fisher information matrix, what the principal components are. And actually, the first principal component turns out to be exactly equivalent to what you would get if you do a regression, a linear regression of the autumn price on the spring price, or in more everyday language, if you fit a straight line to the autumn price as a function of the spring price. So that is your first principal component. And then the second principal component is perpendicular to that. So if you think about what you're doing when you do a straight line fit to data, what you're really saying is, I think I can describe the relationship between autumn price and spring price in terms of a straight line. And I know that all the points don't lie in that straight line, but I'm going to make the assumption that the reason they don't lie in that straight line is just down to noise and errors in the problem. That the actual information content is perfectly well described by the best fitting straight line. Now that may or may not be true. There might be extra structure in the data, which means that their position away from the best fitting straight line is actually important. You know, in other words, it's important that this blue point here lies above and that blue point there lies below. But most of the time when you do a straight line fit, your implicit assumption is that the scatter about the best fitting straight line isn't important, it's just noise. So in the context of principal component analysis, what that would be equivalent to doing would be to say the following, that the data set requires two principal components to describe it completely, but the second principal component isn't important, because that's just the scatter about the best fitting straight line. So what I can do is I can reduce that data set to only being described by one principal component. I can just ignore the second one because I'm making the assumption that that's just scatter, it's just noise. So in a high dimensional problem, you might need only a small number of the principal components to describe most of the variation in the data. Now there will still be additional variation that the other principal components capture, but there'll come a point when that extra variation can just be regarded as noise, as scatter, just like we kind of do implicitly when we fit a straight line to two-dimensional data like the price of fish. So the basic idea here is that you're turning a high-dimensional problem into a low-dimensional problem by deciding at what point you're going to say that all the remaining principal components are just describing unimportant information, in other words, scatter. Now in the case of this example, our high dimensional problem was two dimensions, our low dimensional problem was one. So you might think, well, I haven't really gained all that much. But being able to predict the autumn price from the spring price is what you're trying to do by fitting a straight line relation between them. And if there were many more dimensions to the problem, then throwing some of them away because they're not important really could be quite useful. So that's what principal component analysis seeks to do. Now, it's got a close relationship to the other big bit of linear algebra that we introduced yesterday, the singular value decomposition. So I'm just going to briefly touch on this. This again is more for the sort of the purists. You can zone out for a couple of minutes if this isn't really your thing. But I just want to emphasize that there's a close correspondence between the principal component analysis approach and singular value decomposition that we talked about yesterday. Oops. So what we said yesterday was that in this matrix problem we had, this sort of linear problem, B equals capital A times small a plus errors, that what you could do is you could decompose the matrix A, that's the design matrix that sort of contains all the information from your data, you could decompose that into an orthogonal matrix times a diagonal matrix times another orthogonal matrix. And then the least square solution could be written in terms of those pieces. And what I was emphasizing yesterday in discussing this was that, well, let me just go back to that previous slide, that you could obtain stable solutions for the parameter vector A by suppressing the contribution from the singular values that are very small. Because what happens is when you look at the solution for A, well, you're dividing by those small singular values. So if there's round-off error, that will get sort of amplified. And that what you can do, because they're all independent of each other, you can just really switch them off. You can say, well, I'm going to ignore the contribution from some of these singular values, and it won't affect the other ones, but it will avoid the round-off error getting magnified and giving me an unstable solution. So the singular value decomposition approach was quite useful in that respect. So how does that relate to PCA? So in PCA, you're doing something similar but slightly different. What you're trying to do is you're trying to find the eigenvalues and the eigenvectors of the covariance matrix. So we can write the covariance matrix in the same notation as the previous slide as the matrix A times A transpose. And we know from linear algebra that you can always decompose such a matrix into a product of three things, into an orthogonal matrix Q, a diagonal matrix that contains the eigenvalues of A, A transpose, and then the transpose of the orthogonal matrix. So it's Q times D times Q transpose. So in singular value decomposition, you deconstruct the matrix A into U times W times V transpose. Not the same thing, but a bit similar. And in particular, if we now take that SVD decomposition and we write down what A times A transpose would be, it's going to come out as U times W squared times U transpose. So now all we've got to do is compare that with what we got when we did PCA. So the PCA analysis gives you QD, Q transpose, and singular value decomposition gives you U, W squared, U transpose. So in fact, the only difference between them is that in one case you've got a diagonal matrix, and in the other case you've got the square of a diagonal matrix. So what this tells you is that the eigenvalues of the covariance matrix are just the squares of the singular values of the original data matrix. And this means that sometimes it's quite useful, before you even do a principal component analysis, to first of all do the singular value decomposition. Because you can get from one to the other very easily. You've just got to square the singular values and you're done. But it gives you the opportunity to first of all switch off the singular values which are too small. Because if you left them in, they could mean that your matrix A times A transpose that you need to then diagonalize to get the principal components, that too could be numerically unstable. So it's often useful to perform the SVD first of all, switch off the smallest singular values, and then do PCA. So perhaps it might be helpful to let you see an example, and I've got one prepared here. This is a nice example from image processing. It's another one of the ones that MathWorld has very nicely provided on their website. So let me see if I can get this to work. It's just setting up. So what we've got is a picture of a face. And what we're going to do is we're going to compress that image. Oh, by the way. We're going to compress that image. Let me see if I can just make it a little bit bigger. That's maybe a bit too big because I want to let you see the image below. I'll just go back to 100%. Everyone see that okay? What you want to see is the two images at the top and then the difference between them. So what we've got is the full image and the compressed one. Now, at the moment, the exact and the compressed image look exactly the same. Well, they should, because basically we're using all of the singular values. But what we're going to do now is we're going to reduce the number of singular values that we include. And as I do so, what you'll see is that eventually the compressed image does start to degrade. But it doesn't show much sign of doing it yet. I'll keep going. What I'll do is I'll zoom to the end and then we'll go back. So eventually what happens if we throw almost all the singular values away, then the compressed image winds up really having no structure in it. And the difference between the exact and the compressed image, which we are effectively regarding as just noise, well, clearly it's not just noise because that's got a lot of structure. But that's me throwing away 60 of the 61 singular values. What about if I include a few more? Let's say we include 10. So even 10 singular values, which would be a very, you know, good gain in compression. We've reduced a 61 by 61 matrix to just a 10 by 10. And we've got a pretty good representation of the image. Maybe if we go up to 20. Again, we're really capturing most of the structure in the original image, and the difference between the exact and the compressed does really, to a good approximation, just look like random noise. There is a bit of structure in there. You can see a bit of the hair at the top. You can see the sort of line of, I'm not sure what that is. It's maybe a headband. So the more singular values we include, the more the difference just looks like residual noise. And clearly, if we include all the singular values, then we haven't compressed the original image at all. But hopefully what this illustrates is, in this particular case, we can actually throw away quite a lot of the singular values, and we're still capturing the information content in the original image extremely well. Now, this sort of approach has been applied in a whole number of different fields across the physical sciences that I myself am aware of, and there's probably lots more that I'm not aware of. It's very powerful. Now, it's not magic. You've still got to have a criterion to decide when to stop. But again, a Bayesian analysis can help you there. What you can do is you can let the number of components that you retain, the number of singular values that you retain, itself be like a free parameter, and you can let the data tell you when to stop, rather than just deciding in advance that you want to use 10 singular values or 20 or 30. So essentially, it's the noise properties of the difference which tell you when to stop. So if you've got an idea of what you think the noise should look like, then you can compare that with what this noise image does look like to decide whether you've maybe not thrown away enough singular values, or perhaps you've thrown away too many. So this is a very useful technique. And I'll put a link in to this example on the My Super site, and you can play with the little applet yourself if you want to find out a bit more about it. Another little sort of almost toy example, but really quite a powerful one, is just to show another technique that's out there which goes beyond principal component analysis. It's called independent component analysis, because PCA works by diagonalizing the covariance matrix. So if you've got Gaussian data or a Gaussian posterior, then PCA should be just fine, because in a Gaussian you only need the covariance matrix to fully describe the posterior, because all the higher moments can be set to zero. But if you've got non-Gaussian data, non-Gaussian posterior, then uncorrelated doesn't mean the same as independent. So independent component analysis is just a slightly more powerful technique that doesn't require Gaussianity. So I'll leave the details out. I've put a couple of papers on My Super, which are sort of tutorials to lead you through how this method works in practice. Thought it might be more interesting just to see an example. And it's quite a quirky one. It's one which is often referred to as the cocktail party problem, something that the human ear is extremely good at. So whatever software we've got running in our brains, it seems to be more like independent component analysis than principal component analysis. Because even when you've got multiple conversations going on in a party, we seem to be generally pretty good at picking out individual conversations from amongst that melee. So this is a group at a university in Finland that work in this, and they've put together this rather nice illustration, which I thought I would share with you. So the top row is basically the input data. These are what different microphones would hear, and those microphones are hearing mixtures of different sources of sound. You've got police cars, you've got politicians talking, you've got individuals talking, you've got a little string quartet playing, you've got a singer and a piano. So I'll play a few of them and you'll hear for yourself that it really is a bit of a mixture. I think what, at least for my ears, makes it more difficult is that some of the speaking is in Finnish. I suppose if you are from Finland, maybe that's not such a problem, but I understand that Finnish is quite a hard language to learn and to understand. So basically, because of the positions of the microphones, you're getting different mixtures of the individual sounds. They're superposed on top of each other in different combinations. You run the independent component analysis, and this is what comes out.
Menetelmä erottelee eri signaalit esiin tilanteessa, jossa useita signaaleja on sekoittanut toisiinsa.
So I've still got no idea what it means, but it's been cleaned up that all the different sort of superposed sounds which the original microphones were picking up have now been decomposed into their unique original sources.
The guardians of the electronic stock market NASDAQ, who've been burned by past ethics questions, are moved.
And so on. I'll tell you a couple. Oops. Maybe just a couple more. So it's quite impressive and is applicable to a wide range of problems, not just to do with, you know, different sound signals, but it could be images, it could be high dimensional problems as well. So if people want to find out a bit more about ICA, then the tutorial papers I've put on My Super might be helpful. It could be that maybe you've got some data to which this could be applied. So that's independent component analysis for you. Okay, so I've already hinted about this next point a little earlier. This idea of the Gaussian approximation that's been underpinning everything we've talked about so far this morning is that Gaussian approximation a good idea? You know, or is that limiting what we can do, because actually in some cases PDFs are not Gaussian? Well, there's no doubt that it does speed things up. It simplifies the calculations you carry out, because you only need to compute the elements of the Fisher matrix, which instantly gives you equivalently the covariance matrix, and that's you got a complete description of your PDF. But nowadays, as we'll see this afternoon, it's perfectly possible, perfectly feasible, to compute the full posterior PDF, even for high dimensional problems. There's these very powerful methods out there now, Markov-based methods, that allow you to sample from even a very complicated posterior without having to assume it to be Gaussian. And indeed, those methods can be implemented even just with a laptop or a desktop computer very straightforwardly. So we'll see a bit more about that after lunch. And that sort of brings me really to the end of the discussion on the Gaussian approximation and the Fisher information matrix. But there's one more topic I'd like us to cover before we break for coffee, and that's to say a little bit about how we define probabilities in the first place. In particular, this I hope will give you some insight into how the question of what choice of prior you should adopt is can be motivated. So this takes us back to this question that we posed yesterday about Bayesians and frequentists and asking who's right, and I was emphasising that something being subjective isn't the same as it being arbitrary. If you give the same background information to two observers, then you'd like to think they would arrive at the same conclusion as to what the probabilities ought to be. They should assign the same probabilities. Now this point was made very forcefully in Ed James's book, Probability Theory, the Logic of Science, and it builds on earlier work that goes all the way back to people like Cox and Polanyi that developed this sort of Boolean algebra for probability. So what should those probabilities be? If you're confronted with background information about a problem, what should it lead you to then assign as the probabilities? So Sivia gives a nice discussion of this. He talks about something which is either known as the principle of insufficient reason or the principle of indifference. And at first reading, this just looks like, you know, a kind of statement of the bleeding obvious. It's that if you can enumerate a set of basically mutually exclusive possibilities, like say tossing a coin or rolling a die, and if you have no reason to believe that any one of those possibilities is more likely to be true than any other, then the right thing to do is to assign them all the same probability. So it's a sort of innocent until proved guilty-like approach. It's saying that if you've got different outcomes and you've no reason to suppose that one outcome is more probable than the other, the right thing to do is to make them all equally probable. Seems reasonable, but it would be nice to maybe put that on a firmer mathematical footing. Again, if we take the example of rolling a die, our common sense sort of instinct would tell us that the right thing to do if you're assuming it's just a normal die and that there's no biasing is to give each face of the die a probability of 1 over 6. There are 6 possible outcomes. Our common sense tells us they should all be equally likely. So is there a way to put that on a firmer mathematical footing? Well, it might agree with common sense. How can we justify it more fundamentally? Well, one way to think about it is to see that the numbers on the die are just labels, and that you should be able to shuffle those labels and not change the probabilities. So let's suppose that instead of X1 being, you know, the face of the die with a 1 on it, we said that X1 was the event which is you roll a 6, 7 minus 1. And X2 is the event that you roll a 5, 7 minus 2. So we've just swapped them round. Well, that shouldn't change the probabilities. They should still be 1 over 6. Maybe another way to think of that, slightly off the wall way, is that a few years ago, my daughter got a Disney Princess Yahtzee game. where the die bears the faces of six Disney princesses. Now, I'm certainly not about to rank them in order of importance, so I think it stands to reason that you should be able to permute the Disney princesses, and the probability should stay the same. So that, again, is consistent with this principle of insufficient reason, that the numbers are just labels, so you should be able to shuffle them around and not change the probabilities. Of course, in physics, you're not dealing with rolling dice generally. You're dealing with numbers which are continuous variables. And fortunately, this principle of insufficient reason has a nice equivalent there. The principle of insufficient reason, or principle of indifference, really says the following, that if you have some parameter x and you just add an arbitrary constant to it, then that shouldn't change the probabilities, because it's just a measure of the location of x, and of course you can define your coordinates any way you like, so you can define the origin to be anywhere, and that doesn't fundamentally change the nature of the probability. So what we want to be true is that we want the probability of x lying between x and dx, x plus dx, to be the same as the probability of x plus delta to lie between x plus delta and x plus delta plus dx plus delta, where delta is any arbitrary shifting of the origin of your coordinate system. Now, the only way to ensure that p of x dx is the same as p of x plus delta dx plus delta is if p of x is constant. So if you've got a location parameter such that the probability should be independent of your choice of origin, then the way to achieve that is to have a uniform distribution for the x's. So it's quite neat that the principle of insufficient reason sort of is now leading us towards a uniform distribution as being the right thing to have when your location shouldn't depend on your choice of origin. X should just be a label of position which should not change the probabilities if I now relabel all the coordinates with a different origin. What about if you've got a new parameter, let's call it L, which is a scale parameter? For example, if you measure temperature, we can measure temperature in Celsius or Kelvin, or you could measure temperature in Fahrenheit. So the scaling of Fahrenheit is different. There's a factor of 9 over 5, but that shouldn't matter. It shouldn't fundamentally be changing the probabilities. So the principle of indifference basically says that if you measure your parameter or you rescale your units, in fact, maybe an even more direct example isn't to think of temperature, but to think of something like mass, it shouldn't matter whether you measure mass in units of kilograms or you measure mass in units of electron masses or proton masses. The probabilities should reflect the same information. So the way to achieve that is to basically insist that P of L dL is the same as P of beta L d beta L. So you define a new variable, beta times L, where beta is some rescaling constant, and you assume that that shouldn't change the probabilities. Again, the only way to ensure that that's true is if P of L is proportional to 1 over L. So straight away, we don't have a uniform distribution anymore. So if L is a scale parameter, the most natural prior for L is actually 1 over L. In fact, one of the reasons why this emerges is that a Jeffrey's prior represents complete ignorance about the value of that scale parameter. And it's equivalent to a uniform PDF for the logarithm of L. So that sort of makes sense. I mean, if you think of any physical quantity that you measure, as I've just said, it shouldn't matter what units you use. And if you think of having a uniform PDF in the logarithm, what that means is that you're assigning an equal probability to intervals of the parameter L where, say, L is doubling or L is increasing by a factor of 10. You're assigning equal probabilities to them, not to the actual range of L, but to the change in the value of L. So this Jeffries prior, this 1 over L, is quite commonly used in Bayesian inference when you're dealing with a scale parameter. And you might remember I mentioned it once or twice yesterday afternoon. In fact, you can generalize things rather more, because what I've just referred to is the Jeffries prior, P of L proportional to 1 over L, it's a special case of a more general result. Because if you have an inference problem described by some likelihood that's got a parameter theta, then what you want is for the information about theta to be invariant under any reparametrization of theta. If you introduce a new variable gamma, which is a function of theta, then you want the information to basically not really be changed. So how can you arrive at such a probability distribution? Well, the way you do it is by thinking about the information, which is defined as seen here, it's the expected value of d log L by d theta I times d log L by d theta j. That's where the likelihood can depend on a whole vector of parameters. So, in other words, this equation looks a lot simpler if it's just a single parameter, because it's just a second order derivative for theta. But if you've got multiple parameters, then what you wind up with is the product of these first order derivatives. And that expression reduces to what we saw earlier for the Fisher matrix in the special case where you've got a Gaussian likelihood. But what we do is we take our prior to be proportional to the determinant of that Fisher information matrix. And if the prior is taken to have that form, then it's got the very powerful property that it's invariant under any reparametrization of theta. And it's, again, it's not really sort of magic, this. It's linked to something you've been doing since maybe first or second year undergrads. If you do a change of variables to carry out an integration, and it's a multi-dimensional integral, what you have to do is introduce a Jacobian. And that Jacobian is the determinant of a transformation between the different variables involving their derivatives. So that's really what's going on with this Fisher information. And the reason you introduce that Jacobian is so that the value of the integral is unchanged when you reparametrize the integral, when you change the variables. Because the integral is a volume under a surface, maybe in many dimensions, but that's really what it represents. And you don't want that volume to be different. It shouldn't really depend on what variables you use. So it's exactly the same idea that underpins this, the definition of the Jeffries prior as proportional to that determinant of the information matrix. Again, this lies way outside the scope of anything I imagine almost all of you would need to use to carry out data analysis for your own research, but there might be one or two of you who are doing things, you know, at the sort of cutting edge of, say, Markov chain analysis where this can be important, because what it will allow you to do is to define the right sort of prior for the problem you're working with. You want the prior to be what's called a non-informative or objective prior, which is invariant under any reparametrization of the problem. This is often the sort of optimal prior to use. Okay, so the last topic I want to cover just before lunch, it's been a bit of a long haul this morning, but we're, sorry, not just before lunch, just before coffee, it's a sign of how long it is, I'm getting ahead of myself, it's only 5 to 11, but just before we break for a no doubt welcome coffee break, let me just say a little bit more about how we use information we may have. So we talked about rolling a die, and in the absence of any other information, we said that the right thing to do is to say that every side of the die is equally probable. But there can be situations where you've got more information that can lead you to suppose that the die is not actually a fair one, it's biased. Suppose someone has rolled the die many times and they've reported that the average result they got was actually 4.5. You'd expect it to be 3.5, that's just, you know, the average of one, two, three, four, five, six, assuming they're all equally probable. But on this particular occasion, someone had rolled it a large number of times and tended to get more high numbers than low numbers, so the average was coming out to be 4.5. How can you include that information to work out the probabilities? Well, Ed James, the guy that wrote the book I've mentioned a few times, back in 1957, quite a long time ago now, suggested using entropy as a way to capture this information. That actually what you're trying to do is you maximise the entropy of the system subject to certain constraints. So the way you do this practically is by doing something you've maybe met in undergrad maths classes. You use Lagrange multipliers, which is what you use for a constrained optimization. Again, we're not going to go through the details of that, there's no need, but I'll just try and illustrate it in simple terms. That what you're using is you're trying to work out the PIs, the probabilities of getting a 1, a 2, a 3, a 4, a 5 and a 6 on the die. And the constraints we have is that we know they have to sum up to 1, and we know that the average has been shown from the data we already have to be 4.5. So how do we include that information? We use Lagrange multipliers, and it turns out that the probabilities we get for the different values, well, as you can see, they're not uniform. There's a considerably higher probability of getting a 6 than there is of getting a 1. So there seems to be something wrong with this die. It's not a fair 1. But what's the significance of maximum entropy here? Why should that be so important? Well, there are two ways you can derive that. One is using something very formal and theoretic called Shannon's theorem and multiplicity. But there's another nice independence argument, which is sometimes known as the kangaroo problem. So I'll let you guess which one we're going to do this morning. We're just going to look at number one. So here's the kangaroo problem. It's a nice way to illustrate the importance of maximum entropy as a way to constrain information. Suppose I give you the following information, that one-third of all kangaroos have blue eyes, and one-third of all kangaroos are left-handed. On the basis of only that information, what proportion of kangaroos would you expect to be both blue-eyed and left-handed? So in fact, I've set that as a question. If we assume that eye colour and handedness are independent for kangaroos, I'm not even sure if they're independent for humans, but in the absence of any information to the contrary, we're going to assume that they should be independent. So you expect a proportion of kangaroos that are both blue-eyed and left-handed on that basis to be which of these? Do you expect it to be 0, 100%, 1/9, or 1/3? So we know that 1/3 of them are blue-eyed and 1/3 are left-handed. What do we expect the proportion to be possessing both characteristics? So we can try to formulate that in terms of what is sometimes called a truth table. So we've got the following information. Blue-eyed can be either true or false, and left-handed can be either true or false, and there are four probabilities that we need to measure. We know that 1/3 of them are blue-eyed, so let's say that there's some number Z which measures the probability of them being blue-eyed, and that number is 1/3, but what we've done is we've broken it down that Z here, sorry, I said that wrong, Z is the probability of them being blue-eyed and left-handed. So that's a number between 0 and 1/3, because we know that the number which are blue-eyed and left-handed and the number which are not blue-eyed and left-handed together has to add up to 1/3. Similarly, the number which are blue-eyed and left-handed and the number which are blue-eyed and not left-handed also has to add up to 1/3. So that's adding horizontally across or vertically down, the two have to add up to 1/3. So if we put Z in the top left corner, we've got 1/3 minus Z here, 1/3 minus Z here, and then altogether they have to add up to 1, So that gives me 1/3 plus Z in the lower right-hand corner. So we've got 4 probabilities to begin with. We've reduced it to now only 1 unknown parameter, which is Z. So that's us captured the information we have, but we've still got to work out what Z is. Again, if you didn't get the answer before, you can basically get it now, because the independence argument would favour Z being 1 over 9. You just multiply 1/3 by 1/3. So what's that got to do with maximum entropy? Well, what you can do is you can look at maximising different variation functions. So, for example, you might say, well, let's try and maximise pi to the power of half, or log pi, or pi squared, or pi times log pi. So the one that corresponds to entropy is the top one. And it turns out that the optimal Z in the case of entropy being the maximum function that you vary is 1 over 9. So that's consistent with there being no assumed correlation between the colour of the kangaroo's eyes and whether it's left or right-handed. If you use any other variation function, then what you arrive at is an optimal Z that seems to imply some correlation between the two. Now, there might be such a correlation, and we don't know it. But if you don't know about the existence of such a correlation, the way to avoid assuming one by mistake is to use as your variation function p log p. In other words, by maximizing the entropy, what you do is you analyze the problem by assuming that there's no correlation between the quantities, because based on the information you have, that's your sort of best guess. So we can go a little further, because this idea of using maximum entropy to constrain the form of a PDF, it doesn't just apply to these very artificial examples involving rolling dice or the colour of kangaroo's eyes. We can apply them to problems involving the kind of PDFs that we've worked with up until now. For example, suppose you know the expected value mu of some continuous variable x. What is a sensible choice for p of x given that information that doesn't assume any additional information that you don't have? It turns out, using maximum entropy, that the appropriate distribution in that case is an exponential distribution. So if the only information you have is the expected value, then the appropriate distribution to use is an exponential, to be consistent with maxent. If, on the other hand, you know the expected value but you're talking about a discrete random variable, then maximum entropy leads you towards the assumption of a Poisson distribution. So assuming a Poisson distribution is justified in a Bayesian framework as the right choice to make when the only information you have is the expected value, in other words, how many discrete counts of some source you're studying. If you know how many counts you expect, then the right way to model that distribution is as a Poisson. And then finally, if you know the expected value and you know the variance, then maximum entropy leads you to the deduction that the right distribution to assign for p of x is the normal distribution. Remember, we know that what property the normal distribution has is that it's got a non-zero mean, or it can have a non-zero mean, and it can have a non-zero variance, but you can arrange for all the other higher order moments to be zero, so that the only two moments you need to specify the PDF are mu and sigma squared. So what this is really saying is that if the only information you have relates to the first two moments, then the right thing to do according to maximum entropy is to set all the other moments equal to zero, because you have no information that would lead you to the contrary. And if you set all those other moments equal to zero, then maximum entropy tells you that the PDF should be a normal distribution. So our assumption of a normal distribution in a lot of data analysis problems can be justified in this very fundamental way by making the optimal use of the information you have without overreaching yourself and assuming information that you don't have. So that's, in some sense, why the normal distribution is so commonly used, because it's very parsimonious in the information it uses without reading too much into a problem by using information you don't have. And I think that was the final slide. Yep, it was indeed. Okay, so let's have a break at this point. I think I could do with one, I don't know about you. Some quite heavy stuff this morning, but it's sort of broadening out now into some of these more fundamental Bayesian ideas. After the break, we're going to go back to some more practical things to do with how we do model testing, comparing one model with another.